Hi, this is Christy Marks, the writer of Gem and the Holograms and Beast Wars, and you're listening to GeekCast Radio Network.
I am TFG1 Mike, and I'm joined with Michael Wilson. Hello, sir.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. We are about to interview Christy Marks, head animation writer for Gem. She wrote one episode of Beast Wars. She's done a bunch of video game writing as well. She actually wrote a book about animation, comics, and video games. Most people will remember her from being the head writer of Gem. I really got into that show when I was a kid for some strange reason. But yeah. So it was just going to be really awesome to talk to her, and we're going to see what she has to say next. Would you like to say anything else before we go into the interview, sir?
Basically, I had not actually heard of Christy until I had saw her credits on Beast Wars. But then again, I didn't watch a whole lot of Gem when I was younger either.
No, you just watch Anna Montana now.
Well, you know, it's the same thing, basically. It's girl with wig becomes rock star at night.
No, it's not the same thing. But anyways...
it was very nice to hear from her. Once we researched her, I saw what a diverse background she had, and she was actually involved with many things that were near and dear to my heart at the time, as well as video games currently, which, again, near and dear to my heart. So, no, it was very cool that we're going to be able to have this opportunity to chat with her.
Yes, and you are going to hear that after the Gem theme song. Hello and welcome to this special interview here on GeekCast Radio, Tombcast, and the Beast Unleashed podcast. I am your host, Mike TFGN Blanchard, and I am joined by Michael Peacock Wilson. Hello, sir.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going. How are you?
Hanging in there.
Yes, and today we are going to be talking with animation and television writer Christy Marks. Hello, Christy. How are you?
Hello there. And don't forget game writer.
Oh, yes. Video game writer. See, I knew I was going to screw the intro up.
Nobody can keep track of everything that I do.
Yeah, I know. So what have you been up to lately as far as upcoming projects?
What I'm working on currently is I'm writing game dialogue for Warner Brothers Interactive. I don't know if I'm allowed to say what the game is or not. It has officially been announced, but... when they put you under non-disclosure agreements, sometimes you have to be careful about what you say.
Okay, that's cool. Are you working on anything in cartoons or anything recently or anything like that?
Not at the moment. I've actually been working full-time on this game writing project.
Hmm. Now, is this separate from the Slipgate Ironworks, or is that a different project?
It's something entirely different. Tragically, Slipgate Ironworks met the demise of many game companies and MMOs in particular. And the project after I was there for 2.5 years and other people were there even longer, and the project was canceled.
Ooh.
Happens a lot in the games business, I'm afraid to say. And in fact, just yesterday, I think the news broke of an MMO in Britain that sank to the tune of $100 million.
Oh.
You know, we didn't do anything quite that badly, but unfortunately, it's the reality of the games business that many games fail or just don't get made for one reason or another. And ours was one of those that, even though I think it was a brilliant game and I had the opportunity to create an original IP for it, but we ran into obstacles and they decided not to keep funding it.
Wow.
That kind of stinks.
It's painful. It's painful to sink that many years of your life into something and wholly and completely put yourself into it, and then it just goes away. And it's not the first time it's happened to me. I spent a couple of years working on a Babylon 5 video game.
Oh, really?
And in fact, that's where I met my husband, Randy Littlejohn. He was one of the narrative designers on the game, and I was brought in because I have written for Babylon 5, the TV series, and I knew Joe Straczynski, and so I was actually originally brought in as the person to bridge the gap between Joe and the TV world and the game world, because I can speak both languages fluently. And then I ended up actually working as a narrative designer on the game, and Randy and I ended up working very closely together in the same office, and we've been together for 13 years since then. So, but we put 2 years of love and hard labor into that game, and the same sort of thing happened. Sierra Online was acquired by Havas, which was acquired by Universal, Vivendi, blah, blah, blah. And the game, in the midst of all of that, somewhere the game was killed.
There was a bunch of games lost in the trials and travails of Sierra Online, if I remember right.
Yes, there were. It was a tragic thing. Long, involved, complex, and utterly tragic.
Getting into some background questions here, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Danville, Illinois.
Oh, I'm sorry. That makes me giggle because we're both, Michael and I are both big Phineas and Ferb fans. So when you say Danville, it kicks in.
Oh, wow.
Danville, Illinois?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know about that one.
Yeah.
What got you interested in writing?
I was born telling stories. I don't know any other way to put it. I was simply born with a desire and an interest in telling stories, and also very much visual storytelling. From the earliest ages that I can think of, I was fascinated by colorful stories, fantasy stories. I would sit down and even before I could write, I think, I was trying to draw out little sequential stories. So for whatever reason, I think I was simply born as a storyteller. And then from there, I discovered newspaper comic strips, became a fanatic about newspaper comic strips, and then comic books, and then reading. I was a voracious reader. I just read just every kind of fictional thing, fantasy, science fiction, mythology, the stories of operas. I mean, whatever it was, you know, I would read it. I'd go through the library and just, you know, wipe pretty quickly wipe through everything they had.
Oh, wow. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Is there a, I'm sorry to tangent there, Sver, but did you have any formal training?
No, other than being a voracious reader and absorbing everything that way, and just the usual education that you get. I went to the University of Illinois and in liberal arts, but I ended up moving to LA and working my way into being a scriptwriter through LA.
We kind of already covered the Slipgate and the Slipgate Ironworks. What other, like, I know you mentioned that you have of gaming project that you're currently working on? Is that just the only current project you're working on?
Yeah, I'm working on this 40 hours a week, so it doesn't really leave a lot of time to do much else. So.
Okay. Although we can always visit your website for the list, please tell our listeners some of the television credits you've been in besides Gem and Beast Wars.
Action, adventure. Are we talking live action? Are we talking animation? Do you want me to just...
Just television in general. Animation, live action, whichever.
You know something? I've been writing for so long and I've done so many things that sometimes I actually even have trouble remembering everything. I mean, it sounds bizarre, but in the live action arena, I worked on Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future. And that, which was the first time I worked with Joe Straczynski, was on that. And did a couple of episodes, Gemini Accounting and Freedom One, for that series. And then we were going to do a second season. I wrote a mini-series, five-parter, for the second season, but and then it ended up never being produced, unfortunately. And then on Twilight Zone, I worked with Joe again, and I did an episode of The Twilight Zone that was in at the end of the 1980s, like 89, somewhere around there. And then I worked with Joe again on Babylon 5 and did an episode called Grail for the first season. And then I worked on a half-hour Saturday morning live-action show for ABC called Hypernauts. And Hypernauts was sold to ABC by Ron Thornton, who originally did the CG effects for Babylon 5. So there's that connection. As a matter of fact, he even reused the Nacalene feeder from my Grail episode as a creature in the Hypernauts series.
That so is pretty cool.
It really all came around in a way that was very interesting and funny. So I was hired to develop the series, and I was the executive story editor and writer on that series. So that's live action. And I've also done some feature length stuff in animation. I did a 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea adaptation for Nickelodeon movies, and Randy and I wrote a movie called Widowmaker for Stan Lee for his POW Entertainment. And in animation, obviously we've covered Gem and the Holograms. I started out writing for a couple of different Spider-Man shows, then I wrote stuff for G.I. Joe. Gem took up a couple of years of my life. I wrote for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Then I developed and was story editor and writer on Bucky O'Hare, based on Neil Adams' comic book. Then Conan the Adventurer, which was 65 half hours. I've written for Darkstalkers, Reboot, Beast Wars, Pocket Dragons, War Planets, which is known as Shadow Raiders in Canada, X-Men Evolution. Well, then Randy and I got together and started writing as a team. So as a team, we wrote for X-Men Evolution, Stargate Infinity, He-Man, Legend of the Dragon, Zorro Generation Z, a few other things besides. So I think I'll stop there.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Plus, he and I have worked on game projects together.
Right.
As far as let's say animated features, what was your favorite show to work on?
Oh, Gem. Definitely. I mean, I loved working on Spider-Man. I loved working on G.I. Joe. But Gem, I had a great deal of creative control. And that's really what it's about. In fact, I had that pretty much also with Conan and to a large degree with Bucky O'Hare, although it was a more direct adaptation. But, you know, what I enjoyed the most were shows where I had some freedom and, you know, the ability to have some creative direction on the show.
That's very interesting.
Well, we had a whole slew of Gem questions next, so.
Yes.
Oh, we did Gem already.
No, these are like in-depth questions.
In season 5, you know that thing.
Don't turn into a fanboy, Michael.
Besides, there was no season 5. Shows what you know.
Yeah, I know. Oh, exactly. See? He doesn't know anything about it.
I read the Wikipedia page.
Yeah, that's all you do. All right, so although the actual idea of Gem came from Hasbro and their doll line, how did you get involved in creating the backstory for these characters? What was your process?
In terms of how I became involved, it actually happened because of the writing that I did on G.I. Joe, believe it or not. And they knew me at Sunbow Productions from working on G.I. Joe, and they liked my work on G.I. Joe so much that when this project came along and they wanted rather naturally to have a woman do the development work, they thought of me because I was one of the few women that was writing for animation at the time. So they came to me to do it, and I remember walking out of the meeting and really elated and thinking, you know, wow, this is terrific. My first real development job, you know, it was a big deal for me. But at the same time, I was thinking, this stuff is so soft compared to what I've been writing, compared to G.I. Joe, Spider-Man. And I'm thinking, this is so soft. Can I write something that's this soft? And then once I really got into it, though, I discovered that, yeah, it's a lot of fun writing this stuff. And I really, really enjoyed it a lot. The process really involved taking the couple of very sketchy fundamental ideas that Hasbro had, and they knew the product names of the dolls. Well, actually, they didn't even know the product names of the dolls because they kept changing them on me like almost constantly during the development process. Gem was originally just called M, and instead of being Jerrica, her name originally was Morgan. And they kept changing all these names around. But after begging and begging and begging them quite a bit, I finally got some Polaroids of what the dolls look like so that I could have some visual inspiration. I'm a very visually oriented storyteller, writer type of person. And so just having the dolls to look at, it just simply helps. It kind of gets the creative juices going. But pretty much everything was up to me. I had almost a completely blank slate and was able to just do whatever I wanted to do. And so I went crazy and had a fantastic time. But my process really was just thinking about the fact that we needed to do 65 episodes because at the time that was a pretty standard syndication run.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which meant there had to be a lot of room for development, and this was not really an action show. It was very much a character-driven show. It was more of a action soap opera, in a way. So I really had to have the depth and the layers and the interactions and lots of characters to play with. I think I went a bit overboard on the Starlight Girls. I don't think I really needed to create quite that many, but nonetheless, I did. But just in thinking about the characters, I had to think about the emotional hooks, the relationships, all of the things that writers would want to draw upon to come up with all of these stories. And then I hit upon the notion of the romantic triangle, this feeling, this you know, confusion that Rio is in, the boyfriend who's caught between Jerrica, who he's known for so long and has been his girlfriend, and all of a sudden here's this mysterious and alluring Gem who really is Jerrica, and he's finds himself just attracted and completely torn, and that triangle just suddenly really brought it all together and really made it work and just provided so many avenues to have fun with it.
Yeah, it's kind of like multiple personality problems.
Mm. Yeah, we played with that a little bit, too.
Bob Budiansky, who was an editor over at Marvel Comics, wrote most of the backstory for the early Transformers line over a Thanksgiving weekend in 1983. And, you know, he's still amazed at the popularity of the stuff that he wrote way back then. How do you feel about the ongoing wave of nostalgia for Gem?
Well, I think it's delightful. I have actually been in close touch with a very dedicated group of Gem fans for over a decade now through an email list that a couple friends of mine set up. So I've been in ongoing contact with people, and I've, you know, heard these stories, and now there's even a GemCon. And mm-hmm. so I've been the guest of honor at a couple of those, and they're small and intimate, which is wonderful. But, you know, you have people, there are people there from all over the world, from the Netherlands, from Scotland. I mean, just all over the place. And it's just wonderful. It makes me completely happy. I love hearing from these people and hearing their stories. And I love hearing, you know, how Jem inspired people or affected people. I had one person wrote to tell me that he was inspired and grew up to become a lawyer because of the whole, my writing and talking about music and protecting the rights of creators and things of that sort. So there have been a lot of really, really nice stories that have come out of that.
Wow.
Yes. As we've said, you wrote the original Girl with Ordinary Life transforming into Rockstar by putting on a wig story. Are you ready to take credit for Hannah Montana? And I cannot believe Michael included that question.
I thought, you know what? We watch way too much Disney Channel in our house. And, you know, that includes the occasional Hannah Montana episode. And it occurs to me that, you know, Jem is kind of, you know, she has a little magic involved, but, you know, puts the wig on and she's somebody else.
Well, she doesn't put a wig on, though. There is no wig involved because we're talking about holographic projections.
Mm-hmm.
It's a holographic wig.
It's a holographic projection. Her, everything that Jem is, she, you know, her identity is created by this holographic projection around herself. So it's, there's no wigs here, but I do have a funny story for you, and you might be the first people to hear this story. I'm not sure. About probably close to a year ago, I get a call from a lawyer at Disney, and this lawyer says that they're dealing with a lawsuit on Hannah Montana from someone who claimed that he came up with the idea for Hannah Montana, the idea of a rock star with a secret identity. And so he's suing Disney. And so Disney says, well, we understand that this idea has been done before. And they were contacting me to prove that Hannah Montana was not an original concept, that the idea of a rock star with a secret identity had been done before, so they can invalidate the basis of this guy's lawsuit, which I just thought was not only ironic, but completely hysterical.
Yeah. It's like, please sue us, because we realize that we stole your idea, and yeah, that's funny.
Well, they were using me to protect Hannah Montana from right. The lawsuit, which, I mean...
See, if we could retcon it so that Billy Ray Cyrus was actually Jem's father, then we could tie this all together.
No retconning.
No retconning. Bad Wilson.
That's funny. So, as of 2008, Hasbro owns the distribution rights for the Jem series. Now, they recently put out...
I think that's probably the case.
Again, somewhere in the wiki. You know, they recently put out a really nice box set of the Transformers series through Shout Factory. So we're thinking, would it be outside of the realm of possibility to get a call from Shout Factory about a DVD bonus feature interview?
I wish they would. I think that would be fantastic. I mean, the fans are going crazy wishing that they would put out the rest of the series. As you know, Rhino did the first couple of seasons on DVD.
Yeah.
They had the rights to do the DVDs. And so I did interviews for them, and you know, we recorded things for them. But they never got to finish the third season, the Stingers, and the last batch of shows that had Stingers. And so the fans have just been going crazy, wanting to have full DVD sets. And, of course, you can find them pirated all over the place on eBay. Mm-hmm. So if they had any brains at all, yes, they should be doing it. And if they do it without me, they're nuts.
I was going to say, Rhino managed to mess up the Transformers series pretty well with their overdubbing of sound effects that didn't belong and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, part of me, when I actually thought of this question, was thinking maybe they already did. And she's going to say, oh, yeah, heck yeah, let me tell you about it.
Yeah, and I have not heard anything from Hasbro at all.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's too bad. Yeah, because that would be
It would be nice to get a big box set for Jem, just to have it all in one place. Because, I mean, yeah, there are the Rhino DVDs, but I don't actually have the Rhino versions, so I'm kind of holding out and waiting to see.
You can't even get them now. I mean, they're like so rare now that trying to get them, I've heard of people spending $100, $200, whatever, trying to get the damn things.
Yep. That's not cool. What is the current state of Jem? How do you feel about recent calls to bring back Jem as a live-action movie? Do you think that you would be involved if that were to happen?
I would rather see Jem brought back as another animation series because I've already completely mapped out exactly what I would want to do with it. Exactly how to bring back the series, how to update it, make it interesting, but make it new. I know exactly what I want to do. I've got it all worked out.
So are you going to share that secret with us?
No. But as I said, I have not heard anything from Hasbro. I have not been able to confirm what appears to be just one person's story on the net about the possibility of a live-action movie. I have absolutely no idea if there's any truth to that. I have not been contacted by anyone, and unfortunately, Hollywood doesn't necessarily have a lot of respect for the original writer or original creator of something, so there's really no guarantee at all that they would come to me.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Let me throw this out real quick. You know, you may or may not know, Hasbro has recently teamed up with Discovery Channel to create a new channel called The Hub.
Mm-hmm, yeah, Margaret Lesh is running it.
Okay, and I didn't know that.
Yeah.
They're bringing back a lot of their older properties and putting them on and at different times during the day. And I know that a lot of the shows from the 80s, including like the G1 Transformers and the, I believe the original G.I. Joe, they're going to show on those channels. And I'm not sure if
they're going to. Boy, do I wish I would get residuals for that. But animation writers do not get residuals, or not for the old shows anyway.
Right, not for back then. No.
And not now most of the time. There's some there are exceptions, but mostly not.
Well, would you be considered not so much a writer, but like I don't know what they would call that, since you actually came up with the backstory and everything. Like the Bible author, if you will.
Yeah, it did. I think
it doesn't matter because it wasn't done under a Writers Guild agreement.
Oh.
Mm. Okay. Oh, but if they were going to bring Jem to the to their hub, would they even notify you, or do you think they would?
Probably not. Why would they?
I don't know. I'm not entirely sure how the process works.
Yeah, I mean they have no obligation to tell me anything.
Hmm. Then maybe they'll rewrite a new one. Because I know they're making a new Strawberry Shortcake and a new G.I. Joe and a new Transformers that I may or may not enjoy. I don't know. We'll see.
I mean, it could happen. It absolutely could happen. And there's no guarantee that they would have me involved at all.
Speaking of Transformers, we're going to move into some Beast Wars questions. How did you get involved with Beast Wars? Had you worked with Larry DiTillio in the past?
Oh, yeah. Larry and I had worked on Captain Power, and, I think we probably worked on other shows together, but we had become very good friends. And so consequently, I heard from him when Transformers came along. Beast Wars, excuse me.
Hmm.
Now, the episode Transmutate is widely considered to be controversial among fans. How did the story come about, and were you requested to write this particular story, or was it something that you pitched to Larry?
Larry wanted pitches, so I had to come up with some pitch ideas, and there were some very specific parameters that had to be observed in writing this show. When it comes to a CG show, one of the most expensive things is having to create any kind of a brand new character, because that involves, a lot of work putting all the everything together, the whole
the new character,
the rigging models, and the mesh and the design. There's a lot of work involved to that. So, the basic guidelines were: you can't create any new characters. You can only use the existing characters. That's it. Just the pool of Beast Wars characters we have. That's all you've got to work with. And there were, some other limitations like that. So I was writing my pitches and coming up with various ideas, and having worked around CG and knowing a bit about how CG works, I thought, well, okay, here's a really cool idea that I think I could fudge my way around this requirement, because they could just take pieces of the existing models and just glom them together to create this sort of mismatched thing. And then they wouldn't have to create anything new, really. They just kind of take these pieces and put them together. And so with that in mind, I went ahead and added it to the pitches. Well, Larry really liked the idea, but he said, I don't know if we can do this one. I know, I explained to him how I thought we could do a workaround. He said, I don't know, but I'm going to go ahead and, you know, pitch it anyway. And fortunately, he did, and they really liked it. And they liked it so much that they actually did create the new character. They didn't just go and kludge things together. They actually did go to the effort of creating the Transformer character, the new character for Transmutate.
That's very cool. When I first saw that episode, I had been watching the previous couple of seasons, like all in like one marathon watch. So when I got to it, I was like, oh, okay. But I went back and I watched it, and it really, to me, and I said this in our Beast Wars review podcast episode when we talked about it, to me, how I saw it was, it's pretty much a peer pressure episode. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I guess that's one way of looking at it.
Peer
pressure to me is a little bit too high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really a deeper, more powerful conflict than that. It's kind of like the use of an innocent for good or evil, you know, being drawn right between two forces, the light and the dark.
Yeah.
So it falls into that category.
Since this was your first Transformer script, were you familiar with the franchise before writing the story?
I think I was at least somewhat familiar with Transformers in general, but of course Beast Wars was its own thing. It was quite different than the previous Transformers, so I don't think I had any familiarity with this particular new approach. I think I had to sit down, I'm trying to recall, it's been a while, but I think I had to sit down and learn it pretty much from the beginning.
I know that the G1 Transformers and G.I. Joe tended to trade writers back and forth very often, writers and voice actors, so I was surprised not to see any Transformers credits.
For me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I think, well, at the time, I think I was working on Gem.
Yeah, you were.
And I mean, I was working flat out on Gem. Don't forget. I mean, I was doing all the development work. I wrote 22 out of 65 episodes. I at the end did some story editing, and let me tell you, I was putting a lot of work into that series. I didn't have a lot of time for anything else.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Oh, I'm sorry. Back to Transmutate. Did you mean for the character to be female? Or was it too far damaged to be considered gender-specific?
I'm trying to remember whether that actually was my original intention or if that's just how it came out. I don't actually remember. I think it must have been my intention from the beginning, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's actually been long enough that I don't precisely remember that.
Yeah.
You would think that I would, but I know. because of the way they created the character, it seems to me that I must have given some indication in that direction.
Yeah. And I think the other indication in the direction is obviously that Sue Blue voiced the character.
There is that too, yeah.
Well, to me, it kind of came across a little androgynous. Like you really couldn't tell.
I do like to play with things like that. There was a character I created for Gem called Tech Rat. I don't know if you remember Tech Rat or not.
Yep.
And when I first created Tech Rat, I very specifically referred to him as a completely androgynous character, where you couldn't be quite sure. whether this was a male or a female. And I really wanted it to be played that way, but that was just too daring. That was just not something they could cope with. So Tekrat became very definitely male. But I was going for that kind of Boy George, but even more so kind of an androgynous character. And I'm just opened up my original script to Transmutate, and I definitely wrote her as a female.
Oh.
Very cool. When we reviewed the episode, there was some contention between us about the ending. Please settle this for us. Did Transmutate knowingly sacrifice herself, or did she just happen to fall between the oncoming missiles when it jumped over the cliff? If so, what was the point?
Yes. There you go.
Wait, yes, she knowingly sacrificed herself?
You know, I tempted to just really leave it up to an individual's idea of what they would like it to be. However, I wrote here that in this split second of the simultaneous exchange of fire, the Transmutate leaps from her safe position to shield both of them, taking their combined blast from two sides. So based on what I wrote in the script, I would say that sounds pretty deliberate.
Ah, okay. Well, you win then. Yeah. I had actually thought that the capacity for that type of will wasn't there with this particular character. So it's like, well, you can't actually sacrifice yourself if you don't have that force of will.
At that moment, the idea was that she was, it had been developing in her and developing in her, and right at that moment, the crisis just all brought it to a head. And her intention was not to destroy herself. Her intention was to stop what was happening and save two beings that she cared about.
Wow. Mm. That's great. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it quite that way.
Yeah, that's a nice explanation.
Did you get a Transmutate figure from the Beast Wars 10th anniversary line?
I did not, and I am so disappointed. I would love to have one. I never, ever got it.
Oh, it required you to purchase each figure in the set. And
yeah,
each
I know.
Figure then had a chunk of it that you put together. And
yes.
I've seen them on eBay. But, you know, I just kind of imagine there being a Transmutate on your desk somewhere.
I wish. I had a fan who had promised me that he was going to put one together and give it to me, but he never did.
Mm.
Oh, nice.
You wrote a script for Beast Wars Season 3 episode called Dark Glass, which
yes.
which was rejected by the series distributor. It is rumored that the episode involved Rat Trap returning Dinobot's consciousness to a clone of his body. What can you tell us about that script? Did you base it on anything like Star Trek 3?
No.
The search for Spock? Come on.
No, I quite remember the origin of that one. That I'm not sure whether that was an idea that I pitched or whether that was an idea that might possibly have come from Larry. I'm not sure. Let me think. That was, what number was that script? Number 47. So
you have it?
See. Oh yes, of course I have it. Of course I have it.
Okay, this has just turned to a live script reading. So.
Yeah, really, because the next question is there a copy of the script for Dark Glass out there? We noticed that you can buy an autograph script of Transmutate off your website, but no Dark Glass. We're interested in picking up a copy of Dark Glass and Transmutate.
Well, It's weird. There was a kind of an odd history to this script. One of the problems is that I've actually don't have a copy of my original first draft of the script. Somehow that has been lost. I don't know how, but it has. And I have a copy of the one that Larry DiTilio did a rewrite on as the story editor. And so I feel there's a bit of an ethical conflict there because Larry was at the time, which was a long time ago, but at the time he was very much opposed to having the script out there. And in fact, there may have been legal reasons why he had to be opposed to it being out there. It's been a long time since then, but it's not something I'd want to do without, probably without checking with him and making sure he was still okay with it.
Okay, cool. I think one of the reasons why we're interested in it is because our other co-host on Beast Unleashed, the co-creator with me, Steven Phillips, he asked me about Dark Glass because he does voices. He does voiceover. He doesn't do it professionally yet, but we're trying to get him to there. But he voices Beast Wars Megatron almost just like David Kay does. And he wanted to look at that script to see, you know, if he could actually voice out the episode. So that's why we're interested in Dark Glass.
I see.
So maybe you could ask Larry and get back with us maybe at a later date.
Yeah, maybe so. We'll see how that goes.
That would be very interesting to see that surface after so long.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a worthwhile script. From what I recall at the time, Hasbro felt it was too dark, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
Something about it that they just didn't like getting into, I don't quite know. And consequently, it didn't get made.
Well, they sure love their Dinobot episodes, because there was plenty of them.
Yeah, I don't know why they wouldn't want to do this one, quite frankly.
From what little I had read about it, it seemed like it was straightforward enough. It would have pushed the storyline. It looked like elements of that script actually showed up later on in the continuity.
Oh, probably. I mean, if they ever got around to bringing Dinobot back, then they had to use some elements of it.
Well, they brought him back as a clone, but they didn't actually bring him back specifically.
Yeah, that's true. This was, the clone existed, but was a Predacon, and this episode had to do with Rat Trap attempting to restore his original spark
right
to the clone, which created an internal conflict. So that within the battleground of the mind, within Dinobot's mind, there was a conflict between the two Dinobots.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the script, the idea is you're not supposed to be quite sure. It looks like the Predacon won out and that he remains a Predacon. There's just a little element of doubt in there.
And I think what Michael's actually referring to is in the season 3 finale, Nemesis, the two-parter, Depth Charge kills Rampage. Thus, the half of the spark of Rampage that was in the Dinobot clone was cleansed of Rampage, and he started feeling the original Dinobot. So actually, they did take stuff from Dark Glass.
That doesn't surprise me. Yeah.
Hmm. Very interesting.
It just would have made a lot more sense if they had used that. And
then, yeah.
You know, that would have figured into the canon.
Yep.
Would have been nice. I would have liked it.
Behind the scenes stuff?
Yep.
Okay. The animated series that you wrote for usually had lots of other writers, each doing their own episodes. Taking like G.I. Joe, for example, were there any communications between writers in order to help continuity or focus the characters? And what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, no, not between writers, because that's the story editor's job. And the story editor on G.I. Joe, when I was working on it, was, well, there were a couple of different ones, obviously, because it was 65 half hours. But I was working closely with Steve Gerber. So it's the story editor's job to make sure that the continuity is correct and to catch all of that stuff. So I worked closely with Steve in that case.
Do they just change the script, or do they consult with you first? Or how does that, I mean, do they say, this is what we're looking for, this is the relationship between the characters? And
well, are we talking specifically about G.I. Joe?
Well, as an example, yes.
Well, G.I. Joe is kind of its own thing. And the reason it's kind of its own thing is because in order to work on G.I. Joe, I had a Bible that was like 10 inches thick. I mean, I had this monstrous giant binder because there are so many characters and there are so many vehicles, you know, so many elements that went into it. And the way they did G.I. Joe was really kind of unique, quite different than other series, because the story editors, producers would sit down and figure out, okay, in this episode we want to have these three characters and these two vehicles. And then, and to make sure that it all balanced out and that they, all the characters got used and so forth, they spread that out over the episodes. And so basically the brief I got was, okay, now pitch aside some ideas using these characters and these vehicles. And so I had to look at those things and then find a story for them. So it was different, really a different way of doing it. And in that case, you had to have a lot of coordination, of course, between the story editor, writers, and the producers, and everybody like that.
Right, right.
But that's quite different. And it was complex. Just the sheer volume of stuff they're dealing with was fairly complex. That's not really a way I've worked on any other series before. Generally, overall, however, and as someone who has worked as a story editor, it's very common for a story editor to do rewrites if needed. If it's possible, I would rather give notes to the writer and have the writer do a second draft. But if you're really crunched for time, if it's a very tight schedule, you may not have a choice. You may just need to go ahead and do it yourself because you don't have the time to go back to the writer. So it depends on the luxury of time. It depends on scheduling. It depends on the story editor and so on and so forth. I mean, personally, as a story editor, I would always rather let the writer have that option of doing it. I much prefer to let the writer do that. Some other story editors just they just want to put their own gloss on it or fix it or whatever, or they, you know, their schedule doesn't let them send it back. It just varies. It's going to be different for every show.
Hmm. We noticed that. Oh, what were you saying, Michael?
No, I was just saying that's very interesting because I'm not really privy to that whole process, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I know just from watching other DVD features like on I don't know, Justice League. I know that a lot of that crew, there was a lot of collaboration between writers, so it's not totally uncommon for that to happen. We noticed that
every show is going to be its own unique creature because it really just depends on who's in charge, how they like to work. The nature of the show is just affected by a lot of different things, a lot of different elements. And so every show can have a really its own kind of feel to it.
Right. We noticed that the legendary Wally Burr was the voice director for Jem. Did you have any contact with the voice actors, or were you secluded from that arm of the show? We love to interview voice actors.
Yeah, I never had any contact whatsoever with the voice actors. Mm. None. I mean, writers just weren't involved in that process. And it's funny, I didn't meet Wally Burr until quite a bit later. And it was delightful. When I first met him, I think it was at a party or a gathering somewhere, he paid me the highest compliment he could think of to pay me. He said, "Oh, you write like a man." and I knew what he meant because, you know, he's of a certain generation. And I knew he was trying to really genuinely pay me a very high compliment. And so that was his way of doing it. And I took it in that regard, you know. Fantastic.
Cool. Just a couple of random questions for you.
What is your favorite character type to write for? Heroes, villains, or is there another type of character that you like better? And who gets the best lines?
I like characters that have multiple dimensions and layers and depth to them. And that's why when I create characters, I try to make sure I give them as much of that as I can. One example is Stormer from Jem and the Holograms. She belongs to the Misfits, but at the same time, she's a very conflicted character who sometimes goes behind the backs of the Misfits in order to help the Jam or the Starlight Girls. And so she's a great character to play with because she had this depth. She had these other things going on with her. So any kind of a character like that is going to be a character that I love to write. And, of course, I love to write really strong, interesting female characters, so anytime I get a chance to do that, that's fantastic.
Yeah. As a writer, what is the weirdest thing that has happened to you? Ever been asked to write something that you didn't want to?
Asked to write something I didn't want to. Kinda. After Sunbow stopped producing the G.I. Joe series, Deke picked it up. If you're familiar with the studio Deke, But Deke tended to do things kind of on the cheap. They weren't as well funded as Sunbow.
Right.
And so a dear friend of mine, a wonderful person, became the story editor on that series. And he called me up one day and asked me if I would write for it. And I said, no, because they're not paying what they should be paying on this show. And he asked and asked. And so kind of as a favor, I went ahead and wrote a couple of these other G.I. Joe episodes, which had tremendous restrictions on the number of voices you could use and this and that kind of a thing. So that was something I wasn't quite as wildly enthusiastic to write for. I mean, I still do the best I can do regardless. But I mean, in most cases, if something doesn't feel right to me, or I don't like it, or it doesn't interest me, I don't do it. I remember back when Smurfs was on, I got a call from Hanna-Barbera, and they sent me the Bible, and they wanted me to pitch for the show, and I had never watched the Smurfs. It's just not the kind of show that interested me at all. And I read the Bible, and I felt my brain just start melting out of my ears, and I said I can't do this. This is just not the kind of thing I can do. I just can't write this stuff. I am not a comedy writer. I'm not a joke writer. I'm not that kind of a writer.
That's funny.
There was a funny moment a while back. A couple of very good friends of mine, Craig Miller and Marv Wolfman, in fact, managed to sell the first animation series that was covered by a Writers Guild contract. It was called Pocket Dragons. And it was based on a line of sculptures of these cute little dragons. And they were done, they were half-hour shows, but they were done as like two 11-minute segments, separate segments. And so I knew they were doing them, and it was like, oh, it's cute. It looks really cute, little cutie pie kind of show. And so they asked me if I'd write for it, and I said, oh, no, no, no. And they asked me again, and I said, oh, no, no, no. And finally, one time, Craig buttonholed me at a party, and he said, you know, I'm really hurt that you didn't want to write for our show. Why don't you want to write for our show? And I said, oh, well, I don't know how to write that kind of thing. It's really soft. It's really young. I don't know. I'm just not any good. I don't know how to write that. And he goes, no, no, no. We want your kind of writing. Don't worry about that. Just write us a good story. So I actually ended up writing two of them and really having a good time at it. And I thought they came out really well. I had a lot of fun with it. So sometimes you can be wrong. The moral of the story is sometimes you can be wrong about what you think you can do.
Mm. You see, the Smurfs, they really needed some strong characters.
Yeah, maybe I should have done the Smurfs. I don't know. But
how could you pass on the Smurfs?
That's how it felt at the time.
You know,
well, I was into hard action stuff.
Well, you know, if you choke a Smurf, it turns green.
What kills me is that the Smurfs are going to get a live action movie.
Yeah, they already have a live action movie.
I've
seen the trailers for it.
Yeah,
they're awful. They're just terrible.
I have no interest.
I'm actually on the lookout for further signs of the apocalypse.
Yes, there we go. That's one of the first signs.
Well, I love Hank Azaria as an actor. I'm sorry. Him as Gargamel, he looks like a stalker and a rapist. He just does. Yeah. He just looks like a pedophile.
Yeah. Okay, this isn't Beast Unleashed.
You can take the last question, Michael.
Thanks. How am I going to follow that? Jeez. We found your book on Amazon.com, Writing for Animation, Comics, and Games. And what is the biggest difference in writing for animation versus writing for, let's say, video games? And any plans to write an update?
Let's see if I can take the second question first and get that out of the way. There are no plans to do a second edition of that particular book just yet, but I did get hired to edit and co-author and put together a second book that's out called Write Your Way into Animation and Games. And it used chapters from my book, and plus I had about 5 other books from other Focal Press authors, and they wanted me to draw material from all of these books and put it all together into a new book. So I edited that all together into a new book that focuses, half of it focuses on animation, half of it focuses on game writing. So that came out just a couple of months ago. So I have writing for animation, comics, and games, which is entirely mine, and then also write your way into animation and games, which is a number of authors. The big difference, of course, is that any kind of TV writing, animation writing, comic book writing, film writing, whatever, is linear writing. It's just straightforward linear writing where the writer sits down and tells a story from beginning to end, you know, regardless of what Rick, it may have a different chronological sequence. That's not so important, but nonetheless, the writer compiles, puts together a linear story, even if it's told in a jumping around in different time periods or what have you. It still ends up being a linear story. Games, however, is a non-passive experience. You're not just passively sitting back and having a story fed to you. It's a active experience where the player is a part of that, they're part of building that game. They're part of building that story. They're part of building their character. They're a significant component. And so everything you do has to take into account the fact that you have an active participant in your story. And you have to deal with that. So it's nonlinear writing. And it's also thinking about how you give the player agency or some sense of control or input or however you want to put it, whether you give them a wide open world where they have a huge amount of agency and can impact a lot of things, or whether, like many console games, they almost are linear in a way. You kind of drive them through a main storyline with maybe other alternatives. I mean, there's all kinds of different games, obviously. There's not just one kind of game, and so there's not just one kind of approach. But that's just the thing. You have to be so variable and flexible and adaptable working in games. It requires a certain amount of technical knowledge. It requires understanding games and interactivity, and it requires being able to think of all of the variables and track them all and keep them all in your head and deal with all of them. The linear writer sits down and says, okay, if I did this, then this would happen. But if I did this, then this would happen. And I like this better than that. So, okay, I'm going to decide that this happens, and you make that choice, and then you move forward to the next choice. As an interactive writer, more often you go, if this happens, then this happens, and I have to cover it and write it. And then if this happens, and then that happens, I have to cover that too. But then this other thing can happen. I have to cover that too. And you have to think of all those things, and you have to actually deal with them in one way or another. You don't have the luxury of just setting it aside and saying, okay, I'm just going to narrow this down to one choice. You have to deal with those variables. So it's the difference between linear and nonlinear, and it's the difference between a passive experience and an active experience.
Wow.
Yeah, that's very, very cool.
And there's a lot more. I mean, I have a whole book written about it, so there's more to it. But
yeah, we'll have to check that out.
Now, is that book written more toward people who are already writers, or is that more toward, you know, a general audience?
I had 3 different kinds of people in mind when I wrote the book. One would be the person who is a brand new or a student or whatever who wants to learn about this stuff in order to try and break in. So that was one big intended audience. Another big intended audience would be someone who's already an established professional in another field who wants to shift out of, say, writing for comics into writing for games. Or maybe they've written for comics and want to write for animation. And they need to know about the craft and the ins and outs of that other field. So that was another person I had in mind. And the third category would be someone who, say, works in the field of games, but not as a writer, who wants to maybe move into the writing end and wants to learn about that. So, you know, say maybe someone who's a producer wants to know more about the writing end of games, and so they might look at my book to get, you know, clued in on the writing end. That's probably not the best analogy, but that was another category of person, someone who was within that business but maybe wanted to know more about just the writing end of things. So those are kind of the 3 main types of people that I was thinking about.
Huh. Wow. Very nice.
Yes. We would like to thank Ms. Marks for taking the time to talk with us. If people wanted to interact with you, where can they go on the internet?
Good question. My website is just christymarks.com, but there's not a lot of interacting there. I blog a little bit on LiveJournal under Christy Marks, and so I post things there from time to time. I do have a Facebook page. It's Christy Marks, Roman numeral 2 after it. And I also have a Christy Marks Clubhouse, which is a bit more of a fan page, and I just post things there every once in a while.
Okay.
I just joined that, too. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
We're all about the Facebook now. So.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I spend way too much time on Facebook, I think.
Yeah, I actually shared a story that you linked earlier or today before we did the interview about Facebook suing TeachBook.
Oh, yes, yes.
That's a very interesting news article.
And very annoying.
Yes, very, very annoying. So thank you for joining us here on the Geekcast Radio Network. I have been TFG on Mike, and I've been joined with Michael Wilson. We'd like to wish Ms. Marks good luck with her current work and future work. And don't forget to get in touch with us when you get permission to release Dark Glass.
Don't hold your breath too long. We'll see.
All
right, guys, you take care. Talk to you later.
Yeah, hang on the line, and we will talk to you in a bit. That was very cool of Christy Marks to talk with us for almost an hour. Very, very interesting stuff as well.
Yeah, it was a very cool conversation.
Yes. And we actually got the skinny on Dark Glass, which is very cool.
Yeah, straight from the author.
Yes. Yes, yes. And maybe, possibly, not, you know, saying anything because I haven't made the contact yet, but maybe, possibly, we could get an interview from Larry DiTillo out of this.
That would be nice. You know, I mean, if she still keeps in contact with him, and
yep,
she kind of implied that she does, you know, shoot him an email and get us in touch with him.
Yes. Very, very cool. So, yes, this interview will be featured on Geekcast Radio Podcast, Tooncast, and the Beast Unleashed Podcast. And then also on Beast Unleashed, coming up, we have another interview, this time with another voice actor. Steve got David Soboloff, voice of Depth Charge. So that will be coming up on Beast Unleashed as well.
Exciting.
So I guess for now, I am TFG on Mike with
Michael Wilson.
Until next time. Yay, we actually didn't screw that up.
Woohoo!
So, Christy, why don't you just say some stuff so I can see the audio levels on my program here.
Well, blither, blither, blather, blather. 'Twas brillig in the slithy toves, did gyre and gimble on the waves. Oh, fear the noxious jabberwock.
There, that works. Michael, why don't you say some stuff?
I don't see how I could possibly follow that.
Exactly.
Yes.
I wish to speak to my lawyer.